Master with you, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks. Tom, it's getting old, the success of heat warnings, day after day. I've had enough. How about you?
I agree. I mean, enough is enough already.
It is. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show. Today, midweek edition, Wednesday, July 19th, 2023. Our radio program now 12 and a half years into the program, broadcasting in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio, the radio station 1030 KVOI, Tucson's trusted source for news and talk. We have our worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. And our live line for our telephone interview is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Serendipitous to have booked Dr. Zach Guido. I booked Zach a couple of weeks ago. Perfect timing with what went on at least over our house on Monday afternoon. The Buckmaster Show contributor on climate, Dr. Zach Guido, assistant research professor at the Arizona Institute for Resilience, known as the acronym is AIR, which coordinates interdisciplinary groups of faculty, students, and projects across the University of Arizona's campus, from climate science to public policy, law, the arts, water resources, and beyond. Zach, how are you?
I'm doing well, suffering a little bit from the heat, but doing well.
Man, we all are. And, you know, I had posted on social media, was it Sunday? I said, is this going to be the year that the summer rains don't come? Well, I guess I jinxed myself, because in 24 hours, 4 o'clock, about 4:30 in the afternoon, we were just hit. As I told in Arizona, the Daily Star yesterday, we were kind of the epicenter up at Swan and River area. And I guess a supercell converged over the area, Zach, and it was unbelievable.
Yeah, and you said you got like
three inches of rain before the rain gauge blew over. That's 3 inches of rain in 40 minutes. Then there was the hail component. And it was interesting, Zach, the hail stayed on the ground, at least along the fence area, for 3 hours. And then the wind, that piece of it. The airport had a gust at 66, 67. I'm thinking we were about 75 mile per hour gust during our event. And if that is the case, that would qualify as a Category 1 hurricane.
Yeah, I think it's a moment to think about all the different hazards, some of the hazards that we emphasize less, I think, during the monsoon season. You know, obviously heat is, during the summertime, is the one that gets most of the attention for good reason. But there's also these severe winds that can happen. I mean, the event that you were mm-hmm. describing was basically this big convective cell that could no longer hold up the moisture within it. The updrafts sort of petered out, and all of that mass just came falling to the ground, crashing to the ground, kind of like dropping a water balloon in it. Once it hits the ground, it spreads out and can generate, yeah, very intense hurricane force winds, 60, 80 miles an hour plus, knock down trees. So the wind hazard is one of them. Heat's another. You know, we've got obviously flash flooding, and dust is another one. So the monsoon season is full of them. I'd also say that you know, it was the first really sort of widespread precipitation.
Yes.
The metropolitan area has seen. Mm-hmm. So what was that? What are we talking, July 17th or 18th?
That would be 2 months almost to the day that we last had precipitation in the Tucson metro.
Right. So that is a very late start to precipitation in the monsoon season. You know, if you go back, actually, you don't have to go back far. I'm still sort of shocked from 2020. And that was one of the worst, actually, it was the second worst monsoon in terms of rainfall at the Tucson airport. But the first real event then was July 24th. So we're not in unprecedented territory, but like comparing ourselves to 2020 is not a good beginning to the
monsoon. No, it's not, because the overall rainfall in 2020, Zach, was 1.3 inches officially at the airport.
Yeah, and it was pretty dry across all of the Southwest. There's a little bit of a difference this year. There's been more moisture around in comparison to that 2020 year. Like if you sort of go and use the old definition of the start of the monsoon, which is looking at dew point temperatures, which is a measure of the moisture in the atmosphere. And if it's crossed a threshold for three straight days, that's traditionally up until actually probably like 10, 15 years ago, how the monsoon was characterized. If you use that start date, which, you know, makes a little bit more sense in terms of what's actually going on in the atmosphere. If you use that start date, then the monsoon began around the 8th, but we haven't had rain until then. And that's, you know, we talk about this often, Bill. It's just, there's a lot of things that have to come together to create actual rainfall that's widespread. You know, it's easier to generate the storms on the mountains because you get the sort of mountain weather and dynamics that can influence precipitation there. But even this year, we haven't had much rainfall aside from that one day on Tuesday, that one event. So despite having moisture around this year for at least a week, we haven't been able to sort of squeeze the atmosphere and generate rain. And, you know, we'll have to see how things play out going forward. And, you know, hopefully we don't sort of evolve like 2020, because that would be, in the one sense, maybe we're due because we had such great monsoons the last 2 years.
Yeah, we had back-to-back really good monsoon events. And there was one other element. The temperature was just, I have a little outdoor thermometer, and I noticed that when the storm started, we were at 113 at the house, and within minutes, it was 67 degrees.
Yeah, and you had, and it's in part because you had all of this colder mass that's sitting, you know, 15, 20,000 feet in the air, like fall on the onto the ground. But there's another point here that I think is important, and that is, you know, one of the big media stories has been the heat around.
Yes.
Around the Southwest,
heat.
I mean, New York Times, like I get an alert, like seemingly daily, that they're reporting on the heat, and for good reason. Like Phoenix just broke its, I think it yesterday,
19 straight days. So they're going up to almost three straight weeks
of temperatures
of over 110.
Correct. And I think last night its low broke a record, so it didn't get below 97.
That's right. The low was 97 degrees.
Yeah,
in
and
Phoenix.
Physiologically, this matters for health. You know, going back to research that was done by people at the Arizona State University, you know, it does. If you can't cool yourself, your body below like 90, you know, if the air isn't below 90, it can really put a lot of physiological stress. And that matters for people that, you know, don't have air conditioning. We all know that the swamp coolers don't work well. So there is health implications for that nighttime temperatures. You know, the daytime maximum 110, those sort of get all the press. But the point I wanted to make about temperature is, you know, obviously there is a relationship between not having a lot of rain and high temperatures. So we get the cooling effect, maybe not to the degree that you just cited.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, moisture brings in clouds, and when it rains, there's sort of evaporative cooling, and it can generate like cooler morning time temperatures and take the top off. And so you tend to get lower highs, maximum temperatures. And, you know, we just haven't had a lot of the cloud cover or a lot of the rain yet. And so we've had very, very warm temperatures, in addition to having sort of the broader sort of climate setup where we've had this high pressure more over us and generating more heat. So there's been a combination of things to bring us to where we are today. I would also say, though, if you look at 2020, and look at the temperatures, we're very similar in terms of temperature to to 2020.
So again, I wonder how many excessive heat watches we had in 2020. Probably not. Well, certainly not as many as we're having this July. But
I can't imagine. I don't remember.
I think we're at we're pushing for a record here in July. This will most likely be the hottest July on record in Tucson, and maybe the driest.
Yeah, I hope both of those don't come true, and they are related to each other. And it's hard to say what's going to happen. You know, we've only been about 2 weeks into the monsoon, so it's a little early, I think. You know, when we're thinking about the monsoon in its totality, to have negative thoughts, write it off. Yeah, to write it off. Certainly, we're not playing with any house money at the moment, though.
No, we're going to take a break right here. Dr. Zach Guido, University of Arizona climate scientist, with us talking about the rather strange start to the monsoon 2023. Take a break right here. It's Buckmaster Midweek Edition. Be right back with Zach. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops, craft beer and fine fare, are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rieto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back. It is Buckmaster, and we're talking with Dr. Zach Guido, University of Arizona climate scientist. Serendipitous to have Zach on because everybody is talking, certainly people living in Arizona and the Southwest, about how hot it is, how dry it is. So, Zach, we have this huge high-pressure area that's just been parked over our area and a little bit over New Mexico, even to Texas. Why is it not moving? It typically should move, and there should be a setup over the Four Corners area that would make it very conducive to the wind direction changing and bringing moisture in.
Yeah, and it's like the high pressure system is a persistent summertime feature for our area. It's a broad scale ridge of high pressure that brings with it warm temperatures. For us, like what we want for a vigorous monsoon is the sort of center of that, the center of that dome to move further north and set up generally over the Four Corners region. Now, throughout the monsoon season, that high is going to wobble. It's going to move. It's sometimes mm-hmm. it's going to go west. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's going to go east. It'll sink back down south. And it generally there's high temperatures under that high pressure system. Now, when it's north of Tucson, when the center is north of Tucson, we're actually under easterly flow, and we actually can get these easterly waves that come into our south that help stir up the atmosphere and help generate the sort of instability that's needed to lift moist air from the surface upwards to elevations and causing it to rain.
And the event Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock came from the east. The push came from the east.
That's correct. And I'm not quite sure if it was prompted by sort of an easterly wave or what was going mm-hmm. on there. I didn't sort of look into the meteorological conditions. Yeah, and so in addition to sort of being under easterly flow, there's also clockwise circulation around that high that allows that the winds sort of bring in moisture from our south. So all that is to say is that position of the high pressure system, which underneath it creates warm conditions, but that the position really matters for whether or not we get rain or not. And it sort of moves around. Now, this year, it's been moving around, but it just hasn't been in a favorable northerly position for us to generate that rainfall. So why that's the case, what's sort of tamping it down or pushing it south, it's really hard to say. I mean, we've got a sort of an evolving El Nino. It's a and those conditions, there's some relationship with the position of the high related to El Nino. It's not great correlations. We had a cooler spring and a big snowpack, which might have been mm-hmm. partially related to it. So it's a little bit hard to attribute why the ridge itself hasn't been in a more favorable condition.
We do know, though, the El Nino, the ocean temperatures, some of those temperatures off of Key West have been in the low 90s, the water temperature. The Atlantic is very, very warm this year. Very warm.
It's true. When you look at, when you average across the Atlantic basin, the average sea surface temperatures are like so far above for this time what the second highest. It is a little perplexing, and there's been a lot of commentary about this. Like, I don't think, we sort of have to wait and do some retrospective analysis, see what things actually, what may be causing this. It's hard to say, but the data is pretty visually stark.
I can't recall, and I didn't get off the bus yesterday, and Tom on the other side of the glass didn't either. We've been around a while, and we've followed the news. Tom, maybe you can agree with me on this. I can't recall the national network spending almost every newscast that we carry here on CBS Radio News. Tom, I know you got the headset on. Would you agree with me that this focus on Phoenix
seems to be the lead story on just about every national news?
Seems to be the lead story, not just on CBS. All the national media this summer have really zeroed in on, particularly here in Arizona, what's going on.
And Bill, when you think about it,
hold on, Tom's saying one thing. Yes, Tom.
Fully 50% or more of the country is experiencing highs more higher than normal.
50% of the country.
But our highs seem to be a little higher than theirs. So I guess that's why we're in the lead.
But your take on why so much national focus, Zach?
Yeah, no, it is true. I've been called a number of times, NBC, national NBC, New York Times, like a bunch of times. There seems to be a daily news story on it. I think it's a couple things. One, even before the heat sunk in here, there was a big heat wave that happened in Texas around that area. So there was already national attention on that, and it just sort of the epicenter of the heat sort of shifted a little bit. That's maybe one thing. The other thing is that heat as a hazard has really gained attention over the last, 5 years, and people are really calling attention to the health impacts of this. It does create quite a bit of not just heat stroke or heat exhaustion, but it can also lead to quite a bit of excess mortality. It's kind of how they measure it. So when the number of people that ended up dying on really excessively warm days compared to just normal days. And so you can kind of see.
Bottom line, it's not healthy.
No,
it is not healthy. And I wonder, looking at kind of the big picture, the long term, you got to wonder about sustainability, and you have to wonder if someone was thinking, well, maybe I'll move to Arizona, and they hear this repeated, the daily newscast saying, Phoenix and Tucson with these excessive temperatures. Don't you think that would play into some people saying, I don't want anything to do with that area?
Probably. And then you hear the other news during the winter and everybody wants to be here. But I think the point, though, that another point of why this is gaining so much attention is because there's a huge equity issue related to heat, because the people that are burdened from the heat impacts are largely those who can't escape the heat.
Yes.
So people that don't have air conditioning or people that work outside, and equity is, it's an important dimension of our society. It's an important conversation that's ongoing outside of climate. And then of course, climate has that dimension too. So I think those three reasons, the conditions in Texas, the fact that heat is gaining in importance as a hazard, and just the equity implications of heat impacts sort of all converge and make it an important issue to talk about. But then I also think that there's a lot that this attention is important to think about adaptation. Like, heat's not going away in the Southwest, and it's only going to get more difficult. But there's a lot of things that can be done to moderate the heat impacts on these excessively warm days, and a lot of adaptations that can occur. So I think that there's some positive elements of increased media attention on heat impacts.
I really feel for these people. My neighbors, basically, there are hundreds of them, right, Tom? Still without power up in my area, the central foothills. I know there's a cooling center that the county has set up at Catalina Foothills High School, but still there are elderly people who can't get up there. I really worry for these people. This is really, of all the times to not have any cooling with the temperatures over 110, that's very dangerous, Zach.
It is. Yep, absolutely. And this sort of highlights the relationship between energy and infrastructure and climate and socioeconomic demographics. So, it's a complicated situation. And like the best I think that we can hope for is that we develop systems that can withstand these kinds of events and or respond relatively quickly so that power can, be brought back on soon thereafter.
Real quickly, what are the models showing for the remainder of the summer rainy season?
They're not too optimistic. There's increased chances for below average July, August, and September rainfall. I would say that I tend not to believe those seasonal forecasts, just because the monsoon's a hard thing to forecast. An El Nino event tends to increase chances for tropical cyclone activity in the Pacific, which can then in sort of September and October waft into our region and really change the dynamics
yeah.
and the rainfall there. So that's a sort of large uncertainty. And, you know, it's hard to predict the monsoon, you know, a month out. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. Again, as I said last time I was on this show, mm-hmm. if I had to bet, I would probably err on the side of a drier than average situation going forward.
Well, you were very accurate on this program about a month ago. As you said, it would be a delayed start to the monsoon season. So I think what you're saying about that makes sense, tend to be on the dry side. I hope it's not of the 2020 level of a dry side, because that was a miserable summer. All right, Zach, so we'll see you. We've got you booked for late August. So, boy, by then, if we'll know.
Well, we will have a much better picture.
Yeah, of what's going on and what kind of rainfall. Overall rainfall, by the way, is still around average because we had some events in May and in the spring.
You mean over the year?
Yeah, Tucson, year to date.
Yeah.
Real quickly. Yeah, go ahead.
No, we had a relatively nice winter, and that followed on the heels of a nice monsoon season. So I think we're in an okay position in terms of like that longer term perspective, but things can change seasonally here. So, you know, we get a dry monsoon, it'll put pressure on our upcoming winter for rainfall.
All right, Dr. Zach Guido, see you in August. Thanks, Zach. Be safe.
Thank you.
All right.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, midweek edition. You know, the rains came, at least to our area in the central foothills, maybe a little too much. But the folks over at Green Things were very, very happy to get some rain. Our great sponsor, Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. Their 13-acre site has everything you need for the garden and some beautiful merchandise, like some of that Talavera pottery at their sister business on site called Zocalo Village. So the greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com, the two websites. They Green Things in their 53rd year of business. They are open daily. When we do our telephone interviews, of which we are not doing today, but we will take calls at 790-2040. If anybody's interested, you can always call us on the live line. The live line presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. We're going to talk about the situation in Russia and Russian politics with Dr. John Pat Willerton, who I have known many years. This guy knows what he is doing when it comes to Russia. He is a professor of political science in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona, the author of a book and roughly 80 articles and chapters in his professional expertise focused on Russia and other former Soviet Union countries. Dr. Willerton regularly travels to Russia, has been going there since 1982. He teaches courses on Russian domestic politics and foreign policy, as well as conducting courses on comparative governments. He's currently working on a research project with a Polish colleague, contrasting Russian and Polish perspectives on the war in the Ukraine. Dr. Willerton, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm fine, and I'm happy to be on the program. Bill, I've known you a long time. We've had so many wonderful interactions.
Yeah, when the fall of the Soviet Union happened, my camera crew from Channel, I was with Channel 6 at the time, seems like we were living over at your home on the east side, and we've reconnected now for the radio show, which I'm very thankful for. So much has been going on just since we saw you a couple of months ago. We had this coup attempt. I'm just curious what your take is. What do we know about the Wagner coup attempt? We hear in the media that this was very serious. Was it so serious? Were we looking at the fall of Russia?
No, we weren't looking at the fall of Russia. I wouldn't say it has no seriousness, because to have this kind of mutiny, it was a mutiny. It was a mutiny.
And
it
wasn't a coup. They've had them before in Russian history.
And they have. And, you know, Vladimir Putin and the government reacted. The commentary was on that nature. They put it in a historical context because Russians, they know their history, and this is very scary. But, you know, when that arose, when Prigozhin, this very rich businessman that is funding the Wagner, he didn't found them, incidentally. He has no military training. He is a entrepreneur businessman that's been tied with them and is raising money for them. So he's tied with them, became a kind of spokesperson for them. He's become kind of a heroic figure for Russians, who see him as just calling it like he sees it, okay? Sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong in their minds. When he launched this, because he wants Russia to get going. It's enough with this cautious stance. Mm-hmm. Russians know they have the ability to knock out the Kiev regime, and they do. Yeah. They've been pursuing this with one arm tied behind the back and the other hand with a glove on. Yeah. They're trying to minimize casualties of civilians. Of course, we laugh at that, but I saw a recent figure on NBC News, which is not a friend of Russia, that said so far in this war since 2022, 10,000 civilians have been killed. 10,000. We estimate the number of Ukrainian and Russian troops that have been killed at 700,000 to 800,000.
Oh my!
That tells you how much the level of killing of civilians has been relatively constrained.
Yes, it has.
Of course, we see incidents. We just had the Kerch Bridge hit. A sad story.
In Crimea,
Kiev, they got the drones in. They hit it. Two parents were killed. Their daughter is in the hospital fighting for her life. So yes, there are terrible civilian losses on both sides. But the truth of the the matter is, the Russians have proceeded very carefully and cautiously, I would say in a deliberative fashion. And Prigozhin and many Russians are basically frustrated. They want to get going. So the point is that he launched this. He challenged the leadership of the military, not Vladimir Putin. He's always expressed his fealty to the president. It was to the military leadership. But you'll notice, looking back, no one supported him. Not one person, not one organization. So this notion that was coming out here, Putin's in trouble, the country's fragmented. To the contrary, he's more powerful
that
now.
That was the narrative in the media in this country.
I think
anyway,
it was wishful thinking. This is what we've been wanting to get him out of power for 20 years. So the point is that his approval rating went up. And I have a couple of friends there who I would say are relatively politically indifferent. Okay, vote, but one of them was on vacation in Egypt. This happened. He got upset and he said, you know, I'm taking my president for granted. I don't support mutinies. So he actually found himself more supportive after this. I think there's others like that.
Prigozhin, where did he get his money?
Well,
we keep hearing he's this rich business guy. Where's the source of
Well,
that?
I'll be honest with you. I'm not an expert on his life.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
I sense that he was a fairly successful entrepreneur at a local, at a low level in the culinary industry. Mm-hmm. I also sense there's corruption, and I want to be a little careful what I say about that. That's not a nice world. So I think a combination of maybe some entrepreneurial finesse and some corruption, he garnered contracts, he put pressure on, and he maneuvered his way. You know, there's a lot of people like that that made careers, especially back in the 1990s into the 2000s. So I would say he's a self-made, corrupt businessman.
Mm-hmm. And who now resides
in Belarus, I think, because to be honest with you, he has been sort of excused of this incident.
Yes.
But they're exploring corruption. And I would predict, and nobody knows, this is a prediction, I would predict that the time may come when he's put on trial for corruption. He's done. He's done in Russia. He's done.
But the group, the Wagner group, were they successful as a fighting unit in the Ukraine?
Well, they've been a very tough group that really cut their teeth in developing countries, for instance, in Africa.
They're in the Central African Republic. Talk about the definition of a failed society.
Well,
they've made
money there. And they've been diamond.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think of them a little bit along the lines of the French Foreign Legion.
Yes.
These are people that are contracted to do work. Their services to be outside of the country. One of the things that was outrageous to Russians was when you have Wagner people that are making a move within Russia. They were serving in Ukraine. Maybe they would have ended up Belarus somewhere else. But this is a foreign expeditionary group. These are people that are contracted by the state. They are not a part of the Ministry of Defense. On the other hand, it's essentially the Ministry of Defense that pays them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated. It's a complicated relationship. Now it looks like they're going to get reorganized in Belarus. And I think what I would encourage the listeners to focus on is not this. It was an interesting story. We could have a great movie out of it. Mm-hmm. We need to focus on two major events of the last 10 days, let's say. One is the NATO meeting in Vilnius. This was a very important meeting. The other would be the state of the Ukrainian counter offensive, which began on June the 4th, and we're meeting today, what is it, the 19th?
Yeah.
I think it's the 19th. It's been going on for over 6 weeks. These are the important developments, and I think some people, I feel, have almost used Prigozhin as a way to avoid talking about what's really important, and that's the state of the war, and where the allies, the Western allies, are after this big meeting in Vilnius.
Why don't we pick up on that after we take the break, those two very important questions, because I do want to hear your take on the much ballyhooed counteroffensive that for months the media had been focusing on, this big counteroffensive. Has it been successful? We'll ask Professor Willerton about that and more as we continue on Buckmaster Midweek Edition. Be right back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, our midweek edition. This portion of the Buckmaster Show presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Thanks, Tom. Tom just put up on my screen, it's 94 degrees. There, I always say in the summer, it's going to be 10 degrees cooler, at least, in Silver City in Grant County. Why? It's about 5,000 to 6,000 feet. The elevation, so you're going to cool off. It's worth the three-hour drive over to a great part of New Mexico. Go to their website, southwestnewmexico.org. You'll find out about so many activities to do in Silver City. Let's continue now with Professor Pat Willerton, Professor of Political Science in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. His expertise is focused on Russia and other former Soviet Union countries. Okay, Pat, Dr. Willerton, before the break, you brought up two very important items. Let's address them. This summit and the counteroffensive, how is it going? Begin with the summit.
I'd like to do the reverse order,
go
if you
ahead.
Don't mind. I'll
no,
tell you why.
You're the boss here.
The reason is I think this recent NATO meeting in many ways is structured as a reaction to how the counteroffensive is going.
Okay.
So we should start with the counteroffensive to say that the counteroffensive by Kiev authorities that began around June the 4th is going nowhere. This has been a disaster. I hear different estimates. I'm going to give you an average estimate. The Russians claim, and people that are sympathetic to Russia, would say that the Kiev Ukrainian forces have lost about 40% of their personnel. Of the roughly 68,000 troops that were This is the third army that we've trained. The first one was taken out a year ago, June. The second last fall. So this is the third one. Of the 68,000, the Russian side claims about 40% are gone, killed or wounded. I saw the New York Times, U.S. is now reporting 20%. We're now beginning to report losses. We never really talked about losses. So I'm going to average that and say 30%. That's very serious. At the same time, President Putin came out and he enumerated over 320 tanks. He made that cute comment, well, you know, Western tanks burn faster than Soviet and Russian tanks. You know, now, you know, we dismiss what Putin says, but I have to say when independent fact checkers look at this, this is essentially what we're saying. Kiev has lost hundreds of tanks and pieces of equipment. So the point is that this has been really costly. I'm going to say roughly 30% of the capability is gone now.
Wow.
And what has happened is they have not been able to break through one of the one to five lines. The sort of Vikin, the general put in charge of this over the last 6-8 months, they were developing a very, very sophisticated set of defensive lines. Some areas, there are three of them. There's others, five. Ukrainian forces have never gotten through the first one. So you see, they're going to have to get through these if we're talking about getting to Crimea, retaking these areas. So this basically is not working. Now, as a result of this, I think that the Western leaders, President Biden, other leaders met in Vilnius, and I think they're trying to sort out how to proceed. We're apparently going to continue to give certain kinds of weapons. But we began to waffle on giving them F-16s. Now, F-16s, and I'm not a military expert, but I'm told that F-16s are a very good plane, but there's a lot of others that are more sophisticated. But the Russians are very clear about this. They will take any F-16 down for the simple reason an F-16 could carry a nuclear weapon. So even if we claim they aren't, the Russians have to operate under the assumption it's possible. After all, we had that drone attack over the Kremlin. So now how do you get, so how do you use F-16s? Where will they be based? You can't base them in Ukraine because Ukraine has no effective air force anymore. It was taken out early in the war. The Russians control the airspace. So, and if you're going to base them, let's say in Poland, and let's say that they're, let's say that the people that are flying them are not Ukrainians, because you need years. Let's say they're Poles. Let's say they're American veterans. There's all kinds of possibilities. Now, what do the Russians do? Do they simply go after these planes when they enter Ukrainian airspace, or do they go to the source and take out the base? In other words, they take out that base in Poland. That's a very serious matter. So I think we're in a tough situation. I think what are we going to do? What weapons will work? Nothing is working. What's the next stage? Then the next stage would be to send in troops. Now, what they're talking about is maybe we'll have a volunteer force from Poland and the Baltic countries. I can't imagine the Russians are going to tolerate this. I would guess the Russians would just annihilate any such group.
Really hurts the Ukrainians not to have an effective air force, doesn't it?
Well, this is, I mean, not having the air force.
When you cannot control the sky, you've got a problem in a war.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the Russians are using hypersonic missiles that we don't have and that we can't stop. This is one of the reasons why I get nervous about discussions down the road of the pressures on Taiwan and you know, bringing in some of our aircraft carriers. My understanding is hypersonic missiles, about two of them, will take down an aircraft carrier. And they have the Russian hypersonic missiles now that they are sharing the technology with China. This notion that it's the Chinese that are saving the Russians, I'd be very careful about that. The Russians militarily are more sophisticated than the Chinese. Apparently, the Russians, from what we know, are sharing these technologies with the Chinese. When the Chinese have that kind of capability, this makes me nervous. And people talk about using some of our 19 aircraft carriers. I mean, Russia has one. We have 19. But aircraft carriers have a different logic if you're dealing with a country that has hypersonic missiles that you cannot stop.
So the counteroffensive really has bogged down. So where does Ukraine go from here? How do they hold out?
They're running out of everything.
Is there a negotiated settlement in the
future? We are beginning to talk that way, but the question I would ask is why would the Russians do that? They are on the verge of achieving their goals. Right now, they have big forces that are located in the north that could move down and take Kharkov region mm-hmm. and city. That's mm-hmm. the second largest city. That's the informal capital of pro-Russian eastern Ukraine. As you may know, in the last day, they've begun to very heavily bomb Odessa after the effort to attack the Kerch Bridge. They're basically going to cut off, it looks to me, the key of Ukraine ability to have trade out of Odessa. So mm-hmm. they've ended this grain deal because the Russians got tired of all of this using of this space for these drone attacks and others. So they've ended that. And so it looks to me like you're going to see a real squeeze that's going to begin soon, both in Odessa area in the south and from the north to Kharkov. So I, to be honest with you, this is a pretty grim picture. Now, I did take hope from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, coming out and saying, we are, the United States, mm-hmm. we are not going to get into a direct war with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get into a direct war with Russia.
I think we can all be happy about that.
Yeah.
Bottom line, Putin keeps his grip on power.
He's as strong as he's ever been. He will, I assume, by all accounts, he's healthy. I know we all are hoping for an illness.
Yeah.
He looks to be healthy. He will turn 71 this year. He's in great shape. And I think Russians understand he is the person they need now to see this through to the end. You know, Russians, the criticism of Putin by Russians is mostly they want him to move faster.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to see now. Let's go back to where we started, Bill, on the Prigozhin thing. If that had any significance, and I think it's a little bit of a nothing burger. I think we've over-emphasized it. If it had importance long-term, it may be that it may have an impact on Vladimir Putin, that what he heard through Prigozhin is many Russians share that view. No, they didn't support a mutiny, but they want their country to frankly take the gloves off and let's get this over with. I think that's the view of many Russians. Certainly the ones that I know, they're getting tired. This has been going on a long time.
We haven't talked about the economic piece of all of this, Dr. Willerton. Where is Russia economically right now? Have the sanctions over the past year and a half made a difference at all?
Yes, to the opposite degree. Their economy is the strongest it's ever been in their history.
Wow.
We project a growth rate of 3%. Their unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Their inflation rate is much less, 2%. Their economy is doing very well. Now, we could get into a discussion of this. It's complicated, but in essence, I will note a couple of things. The money that went out of the country, of course, we've tried to get our hands on a lot of that, and we want to give it to Ukraine. We've grabbed some of that, the wealth of some of these rich business people. The money is now staying in the country. Now the emphasis is on developing industry and services in the country. So you get the replacement for McDonald's. You get replacement for other products. They're buying cars from China. In other words, Russians are getting the things that they want, but the economy is growing. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, estimates it's going to get to about 3%. This is while Europe is in a recession and Germany may be moving into a depression because of the Nord Stream, the loss of cheap energy that they had through the Russian, energy that was so cheap. They're paying 5 to 8 times what they were. So I think the contrast of Russia economically thriving while Europe is in a recession is really quite stunning. This was a major miscalculation. I think the economic sanctions program, you cannot sanction the country in the world that is the richest in natural resources.
With all their oil and everything.
With everything.
It's interesting. We're out of time, but your thing about McDonald's, the media in this country made such a big deal out of the fact that McDonald's would not be available in Russia. Well, I'm sure there's another hamburger chain that maybe
Vkusny tochka. What they have is tasty and fast. And you know something? My Russian friends, they were mad at first because they said their new version, they couldn't make fries like McDonald's. But they figured out how to do I am told that the fries are as good as McDonald's.
There you go. Dr. Pat Willerton. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Bill.
And we'll catch up with you in the fall. Thank you so much. All right, that's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show, our midweek edition. On behalf of Professor Willerton and Tom, engineering and producing my show on the other side of the glass, Bill Buckmaster saying, I hope you have a great afternoon.